Yeah, hello everybody, welcome back. Why Bitcoin Podcast. It's just me today. I want to record an episode for you, person that's new to Bitcoin, that's just coming here and asking, why Bitcoin? Why does it matter? What is it going on? You've made the leap to check out a podcast, to listen and try and figure out what the fuck's going on. So let me see if I can't answer your questions. I think it's the most important thing we can do here. Also, I need to see if my software is working. God, I hope it doesn't fail me again. Okay, so basically, Bitcoin is a new money. Well, why do we need a new money, you might ask? The question really spawns more questions. And what you really need to ask yourself is the money that you use currently working for you? And how does money work? And why did we need to upgrade it? And is the current money failing? And any given Bitcoiner will tell you, you know what? If you're looking into Bitcoin, the first thing you need to understand is the money that you use is called a fiat money. Fiat money is a money that is created by decree by government. And fiat money is only an experiment that's been around for a little over 50 years. 1971, fiat money became a thing that the world used. 1971, that was not that long ago. That was 53 years ago. And from that spawned the idea of modern monetary theory, wherein if you can print money out of nothing, then you can never be in debt because you can always create new money to pay off your debts. So that might get your head scratching saying, wait a second here, what is this money? Why is that the money that we use? Okay, so basically you have to go back into the history of money. So how did money start? You can go way back to where there was shells and beads and all sorts of shit that people made. And I'd recommend you go check out Nick Zasbo that wrote a piece called Shelling Out. There's also a book called The Bitcoin Standard that you can read that goes heavily into the old forms of money, including rye stones and things of that nature. One thing they all had in common was that they used, in order to create the money, a human needed to put in time and effort and work and energy into creating something to trade for something else. That's how good money was made. You needed something that had value, that had energy put into it, and that was able to stop the money from being created easily. So there's a term that you'll hear, Austrian economics, this is another thing you need to look up, called hard money and easy money. So hard money is what I was previously describing, something that's hard to make. Something like these beads that they sold that somebody would spend hours and days polishing and figuring out and threading and making something beautiful. It was hard money. Same thing with, which inevitably led to gold. And gold was hard money, is hard money still, because it takes a lot of energy and effort to extract from the earth. It's a precious metal. It's a metal that can be used for other things. So gold bugs will tell you it has intrinsic value. That's an idea that some people would disagree with. I'll leave that alone for now. But the main factor here is that gold takes energy, effort, work to extract from the earth. If you want to have more gold, the only way to get more gold is to buy a bunch of machines, dig a hole in the ground, pull it out of the ground, and then smelt it down, and then make your gold bars. The other way to get gold is to buy it. So what do you buy it with? Well, currently you can buy it with dollars. So what happens if you have a bunch of dollars and you want gold? You can give somebody a bunch of dollars and you can get your gold. That's the other way. That's where we get the price from. People will pay X amount of dollars for a certain amount of gold. So now, what happened? People were using gold as money. It was great. Everything was working out good. People had to work really hard to find the gold, and it was really hard to make more gold unless they put in a lot of work. But gold had a issue. The issue was that it was heavy and hard to carry around, hard to divide as well. So if you, one thing about gold is that it stores its value very well over time. as something I like to tell people, is that 1 pound of gold about 100 years ago would buy you a cow to feed your family for the year, or a nice suit. And 1 pound of gold today roughly translates to about the same amount. To understand that, a cow will cost you roughly $2,000. A suit, you know, any guys out there that have gone out to buy a suit, a nice one will cost you about $2,000. Therefore, the value of the gold hasn't changed. The value of the suit hasn't changed. The value of the cow hasn't changed, because the amount of work that goes into producing these things hasn't changed. What has changed? Well, what's changed is the dollar. So when did the dollar come into play? Well, banks started opening up because gold was heavy and people didn't want to carry it around. So they would take their gold bars to a bank. The bank would give them a note or a receipt or a certificate that represented the gold in the bank. So you'd put in 1 pound of gold, you'd get a receipt that said you have 1 pound of gold in the bank. People got smart and realized, hey, I don't need to take this receipt back to the bank. If I want to pay for a cow, I'll just give you my receipt, and then the gold doesn't have to move at all. And that worked well for a while. But then the bank got smart, and they started loaning out more gold than they had in reserves. So it's a lot easier, again, easy money. It's easy to create a piece of paper that says 1 pound of gold. What's not easy to create is the hard money asset, the gold bar. So if it's easy to create money, what happens? What happens is inflation. So how does inflation happen? Well, you create more units of money, and then the things that they're buying become more expensive in that unit because there's more units chasing the same amount of goods. It's very simple. If you have 1 apple and you want to trade it for 1 banana, and it's all you have, you can trade 1 apple for 1 banana. But if somebody comes and they say, hey, I have 20,000 apples, and they can offer 20,000 apples for 1 banana, they will, because they have it, because there's more in the market and they really want that banana, so they're willing to trade it. It's kind of a little wishy-washy of a example, because you can't just create 20,000 apples out of nothing, but hopefully that kind of makes a little bit of sense here. So the governments of the world started using these receipts as money. And then it was said that, okay, so this is where it gets pretty fucky. So the World War I happens, World War II happens. I should know the timelines better, but it's 1940 something. And we go, and America has won the war. And, oh man, what is it called? Edit break. I should know this. What was it called? 1941. I don't even know if it was 41. It was the, when did the dollar become world reserve currency? Bretton Woods, the Bretton Woods Conference, 1944, my mistake. So in 1944, Bretton Woods happened. The world agreed that the US dollar would be the new money of the world rather than gold. Why? Because the dollar was as good as gold. Why? Because 35 United States dollars would buy you 1 pound of gold no matter what. But sure enough, the same thing happened where they started creating more dollars than they had gold. And so after a few years, fast forward to 1971, like I said at the top of the show, Richard Nixon had to defend the dollar against the speculators in a very famous speech. Oh man, one of my most favorite speeches there is. And they took the dollar off the gold standard, meaning that there was nothing backing the dollar except for the government of the United States. And the dollar was the world reserve currency of the world, meaning that every other currency in existence, doesn't matter if you're in Canada, Australia, Great Britain, the EU, anywhere, all these monies were backed by the US dollar, which was backed by gold, which was hard money. But then they removed that hard money, and now all of a sudden you could print as many American dollars as you wanted, thus devaluing it. and all the other currencies of the world, which they thought maybe it won't be a problem. Maybe everything's going to be just fine. Turns out it wasn't just fine. So what happened? Well, they printed a fuck ton of money. And sure enough, everything started becoming more expensive. The hard assets started becoming more expensive. That's why people buy houses. They go up in value, right? Well, sort of, not really. When you measure them in a dollar, that is getting inflated to kingdom come, as it were. The value of the house is still one house. If you buy a house that costs you $100,000 and 5 years later it costs you $500,000, the house didn't get any better. It's still a house. One house equals one house. What happened was the value of those dollars went down. So a lot of people think that they're getting richer because they have more dollars in their account or access to more dollars. But what you really need to pay attention to is purchasing power. That's the most important thing, is purchasing power. What can I buy with this dollar? What can I buy if I sell this house? What can I buy if I have this gold bar? That's purchasing power. And the purchasing power of dollars only goes down by definition. The central bank, the Federal Reserve, it is their goal to devalue the dollar by 2% a year. This is also true for every other central bank in the world. They really want to devalue their currency by 2% a year. And yeah, that's another thing you can go and get into and realize, well, why do they want to do that? They say it stimulates the economy. They say it will incentivize people to work harder if they know that their money is getting shittier. It's fucking insane when you really think about it. It makes me frustrated. So now we have a whole generation of people. I'm 32. I've only lived on a fiat standard. If you're listening to this and you're under 53 years old, you've only ever lived on a fiat standard. And even if you're any older than that, you barely knew the gold standard because it was on its tail end anyways, and shit was already getting kind of crazy. So people think that the money that they use is fine because it's all they've ever known. This is one of the things you need to wrap your head around when you start looking at Bitcoin, is that just because something's been a tool that you've used, just because you've used the dollar as your money since your entire life, doesn't mean that it's a good money. Doesn't mean that it makes sense. You need to stop and ask yourself, what makes a good money? And the other thing is that, yeah, it's still so new. In the grand scheme of humanity and civilization, 50 years is fucking nothing. Like, nothing. We'll look back at this fiat age and say, wow, that was a big mistake, in my opinion, we will. You look at what happens to civilization when the money fails. This is, to go on a little bit of a tangent here, this is also what has always happened in past civilizations. You go back to Roman times or Egyptian times or any other major civilization, society that ruled the world, they all came crumbling down when their money failed. They failed for not in the same way that we made paper money, but what happened was they would clip coins where they'd have a gold coin. They'd take pieces of it off. They'd be able to create more and more units of it. There's also a story of one king that they had these coins and they were worth, say, one, I don't know, I'll just say dollar for ease of use here, $1. And to fix the problem that everybody was getting poorer, the king said, well, make every dollar equal to two. And so all of a sudden, everybody had these coins, but now they were worth $2. Well, you can imagine that didn't really change much. All it did was change the prices of everything to double because everybody had, quote unquote, more money. It wasn't more money. It was just more units of the money. But the things around them didn't change. This is prices. When you look at prices, you need to understand purchasing power of what unit you're buying them with. So now we're at the point in our fiat currency experiment where governments are so caught up and so addicted to and needing to print more and more money just in order to keep up with the debts that they already have. This gets a little confusing here, but the way that they create the money is by going to the central bank and saying, we need money. And the governments have the ability to create bonds. Bonds are certificates that say, we'll pay you back this amount plus interest. And you might ask yourself, well, wait a second here. How can they pay back interest if the money that they're creating is just not there unless they make more? So yeah, every dollar that exists today is a promise to pay back a dollar plus interest in the future. That's the real world we're living in. It's so stupid. Like, dollars are so bad. They create bonds out of nothing. A piece of paper that says, we'll pay you back, bro. The Federal Reserve says, okay, here's your money. Pay us back later. And then that debt comes due. And the government doesn't have the interest. So they have to say, hey, can you give us another loan? And the Fed says, sure, but you got to give us more later. And then the cycle continues. And so now we're at a point where the debt that they owe back is way more than the quote unquote GDP of the United States. Same with Canada, same with every other fucking country in the world. It's so stupid. So the GDP is the gross domestic product, which is all the people that are working in an economy, how much money they create. So if everybody in America used all their money to give to the government, and the government used all that money, it wouldn't pay off the interest for the loan that they took from the Fed in the first place. So they're in what's called a debt trap or a debt spiral. It's really bad. They need to keep printing more money. And what happens when you print more money? You devalue the currency. And what happens when you devalue the currency? Everything becomes more expensive in that currency. So what happens to the civilians that are living in that society? They get fucked because they need more money, but they don't get that money until it's already been devalued. I guess I'll have to get into the Cantillon effect here too. So you're using a money that's created out of nothing, that is infinitely printed, that makes everything more expensive in your eyes forever. I still haven't answered why Bitcoin fixes this. I guess I should start to wind into the Bitcoin aspect here. So what is Bitcoin? Well, Bitcoin is a new idea, a new experiment for money that you can choose to opt into or not. It's a program that you can run on your computer, and it's just a list of the transactions that have happened on the Bitcoin network. So if I have one Bitcoin and I send you one Bitcoin, we write that down on the Bitcoin network. Everybody on the network can take a look at it and say, okay, yeah, Jeff sent this person one Bitcoin. So now I can't send another Bitcoin if I don't have another one, because the whole network knows I've already sent it. So that's one thing. That's called the double accounting, double-headed accounting, something of that sort. And that's useful because you know where all the money is, you know where it's going, and you know that nobody can double spend it. Double spending is a big problem. That's another thing that happens in the fiat network all the time, wherein somebody has, well, this is what credit is. Somebody has $100 and then they spend $100 at Best Buy, and then they spend $100 at the gas station, and then they spend $100 at the grocery store. They've spent $300, but their credit only said they had $100. Whoops. Well, now that gas station needs that money. So now there's more credit in the system. The whole system fails. Nobody was keeping track of it. And more money was created. Somebody's getting fucked somewhere because that money wasn't there, but nobody was keeping track of it. So one thing the Bitcoin network does is keep track of all the transactions. The next thing comes into the hard money aspect, in that Bitcoins are created every 10 minutes, roughly on average. So if you're new here, you've probably heard the term blockchain. What is a blockchain? Well, a blockchain is an annoying word that simply means all the transactions that happened in this 10 minutes, here they are, link them to the next 10 minutes. So a block of transactions, 10 minutes goes by. Here's the next block of transactions, 10 minutes goes by. here's the next block of transaction, 10 minutes goes by, and you can't add a new block unless you know what the, trying to keep this as little technical as possible, unless you've seen the previous block and have confirmed it. So block C can't happen unless block B has already been looked at and block C has, and block A has already been looked at. It's just a chain of blocks. I'm not going to get into why every other blockchain is pointless and useless right now. If you want and you're curious about that, I have lots of other episodes about shitcoins, is what we call them, and why they're pointless and why they're completely irrelevant. The thing is, Bitcoin's trying to fix the money. All these other blockchains are competing for good money. And like we said earlier, you need energy, effort, and work in order to create a good money. Bitcoin achieves this by using a hashing algorithm called SHA-256. Let's try and keep this a little less technical. So, okay, so we know what a blockchain is. We know what Bitcoin is. It's a ledger of transactions. So let's explain why Bitcoin is hard money. So every 10 minutes, in order to create new Bitcoins, a computer needs to run this SHA-256 algorithm, which is basically just a number guessing game. The Bitcoin network that you're running on your computer that's showing you that those lists of transactions simultaneously is saying, hey, find me a number between 1 and 100. And if you do, you get to publish the block. And so one miner says, oh, is it 74? No. Is it 63? No. Is it 52? No. Is it 69? Yeah. LOL. So somebody found that number. They get to publish the block. And because they found that number, they guessed it right first. They get rewarded with what is currently 6.25 Bitcoins. Congratulations, you did it. Now the next block is started and a few more computers come online. So now the program's like, oh, hold on a second here. There's some more people here. You used to have to find me a number between 1 and 100, but now you need to find me a number between 1 and 1,000. So since there's more people looking for that number, it's going to find it quicker. So you have 100 people looking for a number between 1 and 1,000 before you had 10 people looking for a number between 1 and 100. But what that means is that each individual person needs to put in more energy and more work, more effort to finding that number. And then more people join the network because they want those Bitcoins. Why do they want those Bitcoins? Because they're hard to create. Why are they hard to create? Because more people are looking for them. Why are more people looking for them? Because they want a money fucking ledger list of transactions that's accurate, that you can trust because you can go back and you know that it hasn't been changed, because the only way to change it is to redo all the work that's already been done. I hope I'm making sense here. So why should you as an individual start looking at Bitcoin? Well, do you want a money that is easy to create, that makes everything more expensive forever? Or would you rather have a list of transactions and a money that's hard to create, that makes everything cheaper forever? Which almost sounds too good to be true. And I get that. The last aspect of... Not the last aspect, but another important aspect of Bitcoin is that there'll only ever be 21 million of these coins. So the first question that comes up is, well, how do you know that? How do you know there's only going to be 21 million? Well, again, it's just a computer program. You, an individual, can run this computer program and you can choose whether or not you want to play the game. If you want to play the game that everybody's playing called Bitcoin, you have to play by the rules. The rules say there's only 21 million. You are free to go and change the rules if you want to. If you want to run a game that's similar, that says there's 42 million Bitcoins, and then try and convince everybody to play your game, you're free to do that. Go ahead. Many people have. This is another thing shitcoins do. But you're going to have a hard time getting people to do that, because now there is a centralized entity, you, dictating the rules. Wherein before, it was set out, everybody could choose to run it or not, and there's nobody in charge. You either join in or you don't. And if you, as an individual, decide to whip up a new coin that has 42 million coins, what's stopping you from changing the rules again? And then you have to ask yourself, well, what are we doing here? What are we looking for? Again, we're looking for something that doesn't change, that is hard to create, and that the ledger is, I was going to say trustworthy, but more so verifiable. The fact that you can go back, look at the blockchain. I prefer to use the term time chain, because blockchain has been just run through the mud by so many fucking grifters. Because that's what you'll hear is, oh, I got this new blockchain product. What the fuck do you need a blockchain for? All it is a ledger of transactions. So if you want to do that, just run it on Excel or something else that you can change yourself. You'll have a better time and an easier time. So you get to choose. What do you want to do? Do you want to keep playing the fiat game where central banks keep printing money out of nothing to pay off debts that they created years ago, and then they keep creating, which keeps devaluing the money? Or do you want to play the Bitcoin game where there's only going to be 21 million? You can opt in or you can opt out. You can look for a hidden number and earn yourself some coins, and there's only ever going to be 21 million because the rules of the game state that there's only going to be 21 million. And again, you can just run it yourself and check. If you don't want to play, that's fine. Like, nobody cares. Don't play then. Doesn't matter. All you need to do is find a money that works for you. For me, I'm looking for something that is hard to create, that is verifiable, and that's it. And that can't be fucked with. So this is the other thing, right? In order to create a new block, we've gotten to the point where I was explaining before, you're looking for a number between 1 and 1,000 or 1 and 100. Well, now we're at the point, Bitcoin's been around for 15 years. There's so many people looking for this number that the number is like 1 in 1 with, I don't know, 37 zeros on the end of it, maybe more. It's actually probably way more than that. I don't know the stats of the numbers. But it takes a fuck of a lot of energy to find it. And there's a lot of people looking for that number. And so in order to change a previous block, you would need to go back and change. You'd need to control all the energy to change the block, plus the block before it, plus the block before it, or all the blocks after it. And all you get to do if you do that is change the rules for a little bit until people realize that there's something wrong and they just join the chain with the most work again. So I spent a lot of time when I was learning about Bitcoin trying to figure out how to break it, and I still do. And if this sounds too strange, well, then try and figure out how you can break it, because I haven't figured it out yet. I can't figure out how to break this thing. So what else is important about Bitcoin? So in order to have a good money, it has to have all the properties of money. Let's go into divisibility, right? This is another issue we had with gold. Gold, you could have one gold bar, or you could have a gold coin. Maybe you could have half a gold coin, a quarter of a gold coin. Okay, well now you have this tiny little piece of gold. And eventually it gets so small because you need so little of it to buy what you're looking for that it doesn't make sense. Could you imagine somebody handing you a grain of sand sized piece of gold for an apple? It just wouldn't make sense. You'd have a bag of gold sand. Sounds kind of cool, but easy to lose. Lots of issues there. And to break it up and to verify that grain of sand actually is gold, you know, the chance for somebody to just fake a grain of sand and say that it's gold, there's a lot of issues here. So with Bitcoin, it's very easy to divide it up. A Bitcoin can be divided into 8 decimal places. We call the smallest unit of a Bitcoin a Satoshi, after the creator, Satoshi Nakamoto. I guess I haven't touched on that yet, but a short form to a sat. So one sat is the unit that is the preferred choice for how people denominate Bitcoin now. You want to get a bunch of sats. Sats are cool. There's 100. So to 8 decimal places, this means there's 100 million sats in one Bitcoin. Easily verifiable because you just look at the ledger and see where are they, how many are there, where did they go, where did they start, where did they end up, and where are they now, and how can I move them, and do I control them, and who has access to them. All these things are easily verifiable when you run the code and figure out how it works. So it's easy to divide a Bitcoin. One Bitcoin today is worth roughly 50,000 United States dollars. One sat is worth, well, it's kind of hard to explain it that way, but 2,000 sats right now, roughly, is $1. So it makes it easy to divide up. So instead of having to divide a pound of gold into grains of gold sand, you can divide a Bitcoin up into hundreds of millions of sats and then transfer those around very easily. Transportability. This is the other thing, right? So in order to move gold, it was heavy. You had to pay a lot of people a lot of money to make sure that it wasn't stolen from you. I guess theft is another very interesting aspect of Bitcoin. Gold was always something that people wanted to steal because it was valuable. This is where kings came in and would go to war, and to the victor goes the spoils. The spoils of war is the wealth of the nation. The wealth of the nation, if it's stored in gold, then the king gets the gold of the other nation, and then they become richer because they have access to more gold. And if it's a physical item, then it's easy to steal. If I know that you have a treasure chest full of gold in your basement, and I can put a gun to your head and say, give me all your gold, I can shoot you, and then I have the rest of the day to look for that treasure chest of gold. Whereas with Bitcoin, how does Bitcoin work on this aspect? Well, this is where the cryptographic aspect of it comes in. So in order to send a Bitcoin transaction, you need to sign it cryptographically. To say this in simple terms, imagine you are using a credit card and then the cashier says, can you just sign this? You know, you sign the receipt and says, okay, this is me. So same thing with Bitcoin. You need to be able to sign it. But the only way to sign it is to have cryptographic proof that you are the owner of those coins to send. And the only way to have that cryptographic proof is once again secured in such a way that nobody would be able to guess that number that you hold. It's so astronomically large. So the same way that maybe you have a super special signature that you sign and it's super hard to forge, just imagine that times 10,000 million, because nobody can forge your Bitcoin signature. It's an extremely rare number. It's a private key that you own that nobody can find, no matter how hard they look. And again, that sounds a little funky, so feel free to dive deeper into understanding that. I can reach out to me if you want me to send you some links for the security of the Bitcoin network and your private key and how that works. Fungibility is another aspect. Fungibility just means that one coin is worth one coin. If I have a gold bar and you have a gold bar, but mine has a big X in it and yours doesn't, maybe somebody will value that gold bar that has no big scratch in it higher. Therefore, the two are not fungible. One gold bar is not equal to one gold bar in this example. Wherein one Bitcoin is always equal to one Bitcoin, in my opinion. I guess you could get into the subjective versus objective value. That's a whole thing in Bitcoin right now, but I'm not going to get into that right now either. On the network, on the Bitcoin network that you're running, that you're checking all the transactions, it doesn't matter where your sats came from. You can transfer them no matter what. If you have, I'm not going to get into UTXOs right now. UTXOs next episode, maybe. If you have one Bitcoin and I have one Bitcoin and our friend has one Bitcoin and somebody else has one Bitcoin, we can all move those around and they'll all be worth the exact same amount on the network, meaning they're fungible. One Bitcoin is equal to one Bitcoin. Same can't be said for, this is the other funny thing, in fiat, like there's people that control the fiat networks, right? We've seen where, well, first off, every dollar bill has a serial number on it. And so if the authorities hear that a certain stack of cash was used for some sort of reason that they didn't like, some sort of illicit activities, they can see these bills are not allowed to be used anywhere. So the dollars are not fungible. I mean, there's ways around that too, obviously, but for the most part, you, the individual, want a money that's fungible. You want something that you can trade around that's going to be equal to something that is the same as it. One Bitcoin equals one Bitcoin. Fungibility, durability, transferability, storage. I wonder what the other properties of money are. Are you with me so far? Am I doing a good job? If you're a podcaster and you're listening to this, I invite you to do your own little orange pill episode. I think it's important. There's new people coming in. What if we had a bunch of people, a bunch of podcasters that all put out an orange pill episode for all of the new people coming in to explain Bitcoin in their own way? Surely one of us will get across to somebody in a way that makes sense. Fungible, durable, portable, recognizable, and stable. Interesting. Stable. Stability. Recognizable. So these are the properties of money. Stability. I guess we'll talk about the volatility a little bit. Maybe you're wondering why Bitcoin price goes up so exponentially crazy and then crashes down, plummets after that happens. Well, this just gets into markets and how people view value of things and what happens when something gets more expensive. More people start to buy it. And have I talked about the halving yet? I don't think so. So we talked about how there's only going to be 21 million Bitcoins. How did they get distributed? Well, we know that they come out every block. So at the beginning, when this program first started, when the Bitcoin game started, every 10 minutes, 50 Bitcoins were released to the person that found that secret number. And then after 4 years, 210,000 blocks, it halved. We call this the halving. So it went from 50 coins a block to 25 coins a block. Now, what happens when you suddenly make half as much of something? Well, we know what happens when you double it. When you double money, like that King's example, everything becomes more expensive because people have more units to trade around with. Well, I had $1 yesterday. Now I have $2. Well, all of a sudden, everything's twice as expensive in that unit. So when you have something, in theory, it does the opposite. People were chasing these 50 coins a day, or 50 coins a block. I don't know what that was a day, 50 times 144. Do a little quick maths here. 50 times 144. There's 144 blocks in a day, 10 minutes. So 7,200 coins were released every day. We're now at the point where it's 6.25 per block times 144. So when the network started, we were getting 7,200 coins a day. Now, in this 6.25 era, we're getting 900 coins a day. So there's all these people chasing these coins that are being released. And the only way to get them is to play the game, which requires you use a lot of energy to find them, or you buy them with money, with currency, with whatever the person creating the coins will take. For now, some people are still taking fiat money, which is lucky for us, right? There's 900 coins created a day. And in April of 2024, that's going to go down to 450 coins created a day. So what happens? Well, people decide that they still want to buy them, but the people creating them, the people running the code, the game, the Bitcoin network, aren't getting as many. But they're still using as much energy and as much time, as much resources as they have been. So there's only one thing that can change. The price. They need to ask people for more money for their coins, because they're still costing them real world assets, real world energy. They're still putting in all this computing power to find these coins. Why are they doing that? Well, because they want a good fucking money. That's why. So they're still putting in all this effort to find these coins, but they're not getting as much. So the only thing they can do is ask the market for more money. And what that translates into is the price of the Bitcoin going up in terms of United States dollars or Canadian dollars. And when the price starts to go up, that starts to pique people's interest that aren't paying attention. All of a sudden, whoa, that Bitcoin thing, why is it so expensive now? Hey, I should get some. It's going up. It's going up forever. So people that don't know better start to buy some, because they see, oh, well, it cost $50,000 last week, and now it's $60,000, and next week it's going to be $70,000, and then $80,000, and they think it'll never go down. But the problem is that eventually people can't afford them anymore. And eventually it becomes too expensive for the market to buy. And when that happens, people start selling them, because they'd rather have the fiat currency than the Bitcoins, because they want to buy a house or a boat or a Lambo or fucking groceries, right? So you choose what you want to buy. So if you bought some Bitcoins and they were $50,000 and all of a sudden they're $100,000 and you say, hey, I really want that new TV. Well, go out and buy the new TV, because it's half off in terms of what you paid for it in Bitcoin terms, if that's what you want to do. And that'll happen, and that's fine. That's what money's for exchanging for goods and services. So the value of Bitcoin is going to go up and down. It's going to start to go up because the halving happens to become more scarce, harder to find, lesser created. And then retail comes in, they start piling money in, the price goes bonkers, and then it gets too expensive and the price goes down. This is all speculation. I don't know. I'm not a fucking future fortune teller, but this is what has happened on four separate occasions. The first having happened in 2013. We saw the same thing happen. And then it happened in 2016. And then the price ran up in 17. And then the same thing happened in 2020. And the price ran up in 2021. And then the halving is going to happen in 2024. The price will likely run up in 2025. And then it'll crash again. But what happens is that every time this happens, more people are exposed to the idea of what Bitcoin actually is and the problem that it's solving, which is, of course, fiat money is failing. The dollar is dying, and people need a money that is not going to screw them over in the long term. So really it comes down to what would you rather have? Would you rather have credit card debt, where everything you buy, you have to owe back to somebody? You have to go in and say, hey, I'd like to buy this $300 worth of groceries. Can I give you a credit card? And then you have that credit card debt sitting on you, and all of a sudden it's $350 in debt, $400 in debt because of interest, because they're asking for more money because you borrowed it from them. So you have to give them that back plus more. Or would you rather save a money that goes up in value and be able to buy things that you need when you need them, so long as you don't spend above your means? If you can save a little bit And then the value of what you save goes up over time. Isn't that so much fucking better? Like, I just... It's really that simple. Saving money when we were on a gold standard was good because you knew that if you wanted to buy a suit, you could buy it today, sure. Or you could buy it in 4 years. Or you could buy it for your son in 50 years. Or he could buy it for his son in 100 years. So long as you held on to that gold. If you hold on to fiat currency, it's only losing purchasing power forever. Like, that's what it does. It gets shittier over time by design. Bitcoin gets more valuable over time by design. So if you're looking for money that doesn't suck, I would consider diving more into Bitcoin. If this little intro to Bitcoin helped you at all, share it. Let me know. If you have any questions, reach out to me. I'm at SlyGooba on Twitter. I put out new videos every week. Not videos. Interviews with other Bitcoiners, people that also see this and see why Bitcoin matters and see what will happen to society when we live in a world where the money doesn't suck. Appreciate you listening. As always, if ever, you know what you gotta do? You should just buy as much Bitcoin as you can before the end of the world. And check back in next week. I'm sure I'll have a cool guest. I love talking to Bitcoiners. Learn more. It's important. Find a money that works. Stop getting stolen from by the fiat system. Okay. Peace.